This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Couch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Dark Tower, Kidnap, Lycan, and Cap's Crossing. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the Indiana Jones movies. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news, one more celebrity death to hit and talk about a little bit. We've got Sam Shepard had passed away this week at the age of 73. It was from complications from ALS, which I didn't even know he had, actually. One of the things about Sam Shepard is if all you are is just a casual moviegoer, you'd recognize him from any of a dozens of roles he's been in, a lot of times playing like old coots out in the sticks, or he'll play like a police sergeant or a person in the military. But it's only when you actually go look him up, because I really was kind of ignorant of a lot of what Sam Shepard has done, because I've just seen him in the movies, and he's been in dozens of them. Of course, one of the biggest ones is he played Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff, not Alan Shepard, which would have been an interesting Sam Shepard playing Alan Shepard. But he had a career that was very deep and very thick in plays and stage acting. He wrote something like 44 plays, which I had never seen. I mean, I'd never seen him perform any of these, or I wasn't very familiar with his theatrical work. And that's fascinating when you have an actor who you always just think is just some character actor who shows up in a lot of films, and he is really in the spotlight as a creator of stuff and a much more integral part to the developing story. And he wrote books and essays, and so he was actually a very accomplished. Talk about having a long, illustrious career. So rest in peace, Sam Shepard. Couple little pieces I want to talk about. This is a little bit old news, but I've railed against social justice warriors online before, mainly because I think that there's a lot of social issues that need to be raised and need to be people can take concern about. And especially if you're talking about movies, movies can pioneer and help push thought in certain directions, which is good. But the problem is, this is what happens when you deal with, and it's a term that's becoming popular, woke Twitter. There are people who just are never happy. And there are people who, you know, no amount of female directors, no amount of Patty Jenkins making Wonder Woman and having been the highest grossing film of the year or the summer, no amount of that is going to make up for the fact that they're going to suddenly get mad at other movies. These are the kind of people that were like mad at Avengers 2 because they thought it was slut-shaming Black Widow. I mean, we get these stories all the time, and I always have to sit there and be like, really, people, just calm down a little bit. And the big thing that blindsided me this summer was these claims of sexism about the movie Planet of the Apes, or War for the Planet of the Apes. And people were complaining that they're were no female characters in it, no speaking parts, moreover, for characters in War for the Planet of the Apes. And the only female characters are like the little girl who's marginalized, or you maybe see a woman in the background. But and I saw somebody complaining because the little girl in there literally doesn't talk because she's been affected by, you know, the simian virus. And I had to sit there and say, really, let's also pump the brakes here. First of all, very few people had speaking roles in this movie. If you talk about main characters, most of them are apes in this movie. In terms of the human characters, you have Woody Harrelson, which is basically the only main human character. That's it. And everybody else is either one-liners or very, very small characters. The girl is in there, but she's integral to the story. And yeah, she's just doesn't have much to say or do. And she's kind of just along for the ride, but you still have a female character there. And if you actually look at like the apes, first of all, the character of Maurice, which is a male ape, but it's played by a female in mocap. That's a main character, but also Judy Greer plays the role of Caesar's wife. And I think, if I may not remember it exactly, but I believe she has lines, but they're sign language, which is most of the apes. Very few of the apes actually speak. It's mostly just like Caesar and Bad Ape are really the only ones that speak. Everybody else will use sign language. And I'm looking at this complaint about this movie and I'm like, well, that's just the story. Also, you have to look at it and say, let's look at it realistically. If this is a war, apes versus the humans, and at least from the ape side, because that's whose perspective you're coming at. And when you get in the human compound, there's only a handful of people who even have lines, let alone a character. But from the ape's perspective, in a tribal war setting, which is what this is, I don't care whether it's sexist or not, you're going to protect the women and children. Because for simple biology, and this is not me being a sexist, this is me just saying this is how stuff develops in nature, and there's a reason for it. Men are expendable. You can have a community and you have fewer men in there because in terms of procreating the species, you only need a couple of them to do their job. It takes just, you know, a couple minutes for a guy to be involved in that from a biological standpoint. It's many, many months for the female to be involved. That's why you don't send in these tribal species. You generally don't send the females off to war. And that's totally what happens here. And it's about the soldiers and it's about so having female soldiers in that ape soldiers or female characters fighting the war, that's absurd and doesn't work. Are we at that point where we need to say, okay, we have to ignore reality of what would actually happen in a situation like this in order to put enough bean counted female lines in the movie, even though nobody speaks and everyone uses sign language? This is the most absurd thing. They also complain about Dunkirk because and I wasn't a huge fan of Dunkirk, but that's the least of my worries is that there weren't enough women represented in the movie. I mean, people. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to hit is, oh dear God, Butu, A Madea Halloween.
The hell wrong with you?
I hit the brakes. Look, 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 look. I got this. Y'all sit there and hush. Madea! Oh, hell no. Surprise!
I saw this movie, and I'm going to show you what they do.
I changed my mind.
The biggest complaint I have about this, because I've become numb to the fact that Madea is just awful, shouldn't this be called Boo to Another Madea Halloween? Because saying Boo to A Madea Halloween, wasn't the first movie A Madea Halloween? And so is this, I'm more worried about the grammar and the accuracy of the title of this one. This just looks terrible. It just resonates to me that Madea isn't funny. I thought she'd be funny on her own, but she's not funny. Oh, it's awful. It looks terrible. I may have to see it anyways. The next one I want to talk about is Death Wish. Opens on November 22nd.
911, what is your emergency?
There's men, they're breaking into my house. I think they're here.
No.
I failed to protect them.
The men who did it are out there.
So there's nothing that you can do? Is that what you're saying?
If a man really wants to protect what's his,
I want to buy a gun.
He has to do it for himself.
Who are you?
Your last customer.
You're not a cop!
Somebody has to do it!
This is, of course, Eli Roth's remake of the classic movie with Charles Bronson, and it stars Bruce Willis, which is a good choice. The problem is Eli Roth doesn't understand human emotion. He sort of like parodies it, and this doesn't look like it actually hits hard emotionally. This movie just kind of looks like it turns into a revelation of violence, whereas the original movie was there's a real a lot of heart. And maybe it's just because they throw in that Back in Black by AC/DC at the end and kind of make it a fun trailer. But Death Wish was never a fun movie. Death Wish was about a grieving man taking it out on society in the only way he knew how. Eli Roth doesn't instill a lot of confidence in me. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kidnap and Lycan. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. I'm going to start off with Kidnap, starring Halle Berry and nobody else. A single mother relentlessly pursues kidnappers who abduct her son from a public park.
They've got my son! Help me! Oh, God! Don't hurt him! We got the police! Help me! They've got my son!
My son's been kidnapped.
If you wait with me here, ma'am, we'll file a report right now.
They wait.
In a lot of ways, this film reminds me of the movie The Call, which Halle Berry made like 4 or 5 years ago, at where she played a 911 operator. And it's a very different role for her, because in that movie, she was the operator and she was on the phone. I think at one point she gets out of the 911 office, but the whole thing is she's trying to help a girl that's kidnapped. But you're dealing with a similar situation, only this one she's the mom trying to catch her son. But it is one of those movies that kind of like in the September, August time frame where it's not going to be a big movie, but it's one of those throwaway little thrillers that you can put a big name in and get it released in theaters. And I'll say about this one, I'm a parent. I got three boys and I love my kids and I take care of occasionally my cousins, who, if you follow me on social media, you've seen them. I got a cousin who's like 1.5 and one who's 3, and I take care of them. And I mean, I'm a big parent guy. So my buttons are easily pushed with a movie like this and for how simple the story is. Cause it's just about this woman. It's a very cliched story. She's a single mom and raising the kid and the dad's trying to get custody and she's dealing with the stress of that, but also wanting to be a good mom at the same time. And then the mama bear comes out when they take her kid and she goes after him. That gets me. That I can totally get behind a movie like that. And I, even though there are times when I would say I second guess a lot of her decisions, like as I'm watching this, I'd be like, I just crashed the car. I'd crash into this car that you're right at, because I'd rather crash the car and at least know where they are than to have them just disappear. But she doesn't do that, because the movie would have been over in about 15 minutes if she did that. And it does escalate at a certain point, but I mean, really, it's just her chasing these kidnappers down. And so it's simple. It's not a whole lot to it. It's like a Lifetime movie of the week with a bigger budget and maybe some R-rated content. But I didn't find it unentertaining. I'm watching it. I'm like, I'm into the movie. It runs a breezy. It's 82 minutes, I think, with credits at the end. So you get through it really quickly. It knows exactly what it's supposed to be. This movie is not trying to win Halle Berry another Academy Award, and neither was The Call a couple years ago. And I kind of give her credit for just saying, you know, I mean, she's in her 40s. I mean, she's sort of past her young ingenue, sexy newcomer look. I mean, she's playing moms now and I think she still looks great. And she realizes that she's not going to get the super young girl role. So she's going for the movie and she's doing the action movie, and you know, she's done movies like this before. Hey, you know what? If we had a Halle Berry movie that came out, you know, every year or two about her trying to track down some criminal, I'd be all for that. I enjoyed the heck out of The Call. And I have to say I enjoyed this one simply because, yeah, it's a disposable movie, but it's really, and I know there are people who hate the term check your brain at the door kind of movie, but it is a check your brain at the door. You know, you're not looking for depth, and don't take one of my kids because I'll chase you down in my minivan as well. Although I don't have a minivan anymore. Although I may have chased somebody once in a minivan. Oh, I can't. I've said too much. Anyways. But no, I have to say this was enjoyable. So yeah, Kidnap kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Lycan, a much smaller release this week, in limited release, and then I think it comes out on VOD in about a month. In 1986, a group of college students travel into the woods to research the legend of a werewolf.
Have you guys ever heard of the werewolf of Talbot County? In 1848, a bunch of local residents were complaining about their sheep being killed. Whole flocks slaughtered. A couple farmers got together looking for a bounty hunter to kill, you know, whatever animal was responsible.
Help me. This is a basic 20-somethings in the woods, doing stuff that 20-somethings in the woods would do, and then, of course, something bad happens. In a little bit, it reminds me, setup-wise, of Blair Witch. Not because they're doing found footage, although the guy does run around with a film camera for a while, because in 1986, they don't have the video camera yet. I mean, they did. I think they had video cameras then, but they were huge. So he has a Super 8 camera that he keeps running around shooting parts of it, but they don't do it as a found footage movie, which is a huge plus. And also, I wouldn't say they're all 20-something, because I think the woman, Antonia Ramirez, who you've seen her in films like, I mean, she was in Heroes, and she was in X-Men The Last Stand, and American Reunion, and Premium Rush. She's a very attractive Latina. But she's like 38. And she can certainly play in her 20s. She looks great. For 38, she looks, I mean, for 20, she looks great. But she plays a college student, and it does fall into a lot of similar tropes that you've seen. It falls into the, we've got the hot girl who's the sorority girl, and then she's got her pledge with her, and she likes the guy, but then the guy likes the Latina girl, and she's got a mysterious past, and it's a question of did somebody do this or did somebody do that? But the story is about the Talbot County werewolf, which is actually based on a true story down in Georgia. And like I said, it runs through a lot of the kids in the woods kind of tropes. You know, there's cabin in the woods story. There's campground stories like Jason and Friday the 13th. And then there are kids camping in the woods kind of story. And that's what it falls into. It gets a bit cliche, of course, because that's the kind of movie it is. And I give it some points for being, you know, having the horror movie elements to it. And it always bothers me when you have a movie that's supposed to be an edgy horror movie and there's no nudity and there's no blood and it's, they don't have swear. You know, it's like, that's kind of part of the staple of these slasher movies, especially if it takes place in 1986. At the very least, you should give a nod to the movies that were being made in 1986. And this movie does start off with a sex scene, and there is some skin, and there is a lot of blood in there. So I think that on that level, it works. I also give it credit for trying, maybe not completely successfully, but it does do some interesting things in terms of explaining how things work out. It's not just super straightforward, you know, what's telegraphed to you, although you can probably guess what goes on. So it's a quick movie. It's less than 90 minutes. And for a disposable or a horror movie that's not known to be out there, it's not terribly edgy. It's not like one of these that's going to redefine horror movies. It is trying to just kind of spin a bit off of sort of like the classic slasher movies with a different angle. But, you know, for what it is, for 90 minutes of entertainment, it works for what it is. So I'll say that Lycan kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Stephen King's The Dark Tower. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about The Dark Tower. Before I talk about the movie, I want to talk a little bit about the series in the book form. This is important because really to kind of understand my review and kind of how I approached it, you have to understand what you're not getting. The Dark Tower actually started out many years ago in Stephen King's writing career. He wrote a series of short stories back in the late 70s and early 80s. Then he compiled them together, and they were about 225 pages, published them in book form, in a very limited run for a book called The Gunslinger. And that was published in 1982. I think they did a 10,000 print run, which is not a bad size run for just an average book, but for a Stephen King book, especially in 1982. That was extremely small, very, very small. And I think some of them from that run got damaged. And what had happened was since it got published, they started putting it in King's bibliography in the beginning of his books, like in 1983, you know, in Pet Sematary. You know, Stephen King had this book, The Gunslinger, and nobody knew where to get it. And so people started calling all, you know, his offices and the publisher's office asking for a copy of the book. Well, they decided to do another print run, so they did a second printing in 1984, and it was another 10,000 run, partly to replenish the books that were damaged, but also just to have it out there again. And I actually ended up with a copy of that. I actually have a copy of that second edition, and it's worth like $300 now. I got it at a library book sale for $1 back in the late 80s. But I had gotten a copy of it, and I read it sometime in the mid-80s, I believe I read it before he released it as a trade paperback. And he went back in 1988 and he revised it and then released his trade paperback, so it made a little more cohesive sense. And then he started writing the sequels, and he wrote the sequels through the 90s and into the 2000s. And I read the second one as well, which is The Drawing of the Three, and then The Wastelands, and then Wizard and Glass I read in, I think it was the early 2000s or right at the end of the 1990s. And that's where it lost me. Personally, I thought it was an interesting universe to exist in, but like Wizard and Glass, just it says, oh, there's a story of Roland, but we're not going to tell that story. We're going to tell this whole other story. You bought the book about wanting to see what goes on with him? Yeah, that's not what this is about. We're going to like fill in all these gaps and give all this history. And I'm just like, well, it was well written. It wasn't the story I wanted. And I finally just said, I'm done. I mean, it's spinning out of control at that point. And even if you look at the length of the books, his first book was like 220 pages. By the time he's in this last book, it's like 850 or something, which is very typical Stephen King. He finds characters and does side stories, and it grows and it grows and it grows. So he finally wraps up the stories in 2004, but then there's other things. There's like comic books made, and there's like a prologue he does, and there's another book that's sort of like starting a new story that he did like in 2012. There's a lot of Dark Tower stuff out there, and it's a full series, sort of like how the Game of Thrones is a series. And there was always been talk, they've been wanting to do a movie for years, but they couldn't figure out a way to do it. And he just made the story bigger and more complex as they're trying to figure out how to make a movie out of this. And they talked about doing a mini series. And then at one point they're going to make a TV series. And I think in sort of like a post Game of Thrones world, this could work, but it may not, you know, it just may not click. Cause when it comes to books, you can have a lot of fans of books, but even if every single fan of a book goes and sees the movie can bomb. You have to have a crossover to the mainstream for it to be a movie. Now, I think they could have done it in a Game of Thrones kind of style, now that Game of Thrones has become huge, But that's, of course, getting that thing developed, and then it's still a huge risk. And they were like going to do like 3 movies and a TV series. There's a huge amount that was going to come from this, but then they settled on making this like 97-minute movie. And let's talk a little bit about that. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue talking about The Dark Tower and play a little trailer for the movie that's out right now. Idris Elba plays Roland the Gunslinger, who partners with a boy from New York City to defeat the Man in Black, a sorcerer who wants to tear down the Dark Tower, which keeps untold evil out of this world.
Why does the Man in Black want to destroy the tower?
The tower protects both our worlds. If it falls, hell will be unleashed.
He's like the devil, isn't he?
No, he's worse.
You can't stop what's coming. Death always wins.
Your world might be gone, but mine isn't. You let that tower fall, billions of people die.
Now, this is a standalone movie. King has come out and said that this is not meant to be an adaptation of the entire series at all, because it's an hour and a half and it's a huge book series. And it's more meant to be kind of like a sort of a sequel, because it deals with stuff that apparently happens at the end of the Dark Tower's last book, book 7. But you don't even really need to know that. If you've never read the series and you've never read the books, you're actually better off to see the movie. Because I think if you are a fan of the series and you've read all 7 books and you've read the appendices and you've read the beginning and the prologue and you've read the spin-off sequel that comes after The Dark Tower in 2012, and if you read the comic books and if you listen to the audiobooks, you're going to be disappointed with this film. Because you will never get a 97-minute movie that will deal with the complexity and depth and density of these books. And I think what some of the fans forget is, if you go back and you read The Gunslinger, the very first one, it's not a great book. I remember I read it and I thought, it's okay. And some of the stuff he used in that, he spun off and sort of, that was his playground before he did The Talisman with Peter Straub in the 80s. But The Gunslinger feels incomplete and disjointed. So I think just making a movie of The Gunslinger would have been a mistake as well, because it just is starting these ideas. But then they get developed over the course of 7 books. There's no way you could have crammed all that in there. And yes, you could have done a TV series, but like I said, they're making a movie. So they kind of have a simplified, scaled down version of the film. But like I said, if you know the books really well, you're not going to get what you want in this movie. With that said, I didn't think it was completely unenjoyable. I found it interesting. There's some great Easter eggs in the beginning. There's like references to Cujo and Christine and It with a Pennywise reference and The Shining. And there's a lot of little nuanced nods to Stephen King material over the years. And the acting actually does a great job casting. Now, Roland the Gunslinger was originally based on Clint Eastwood from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He kind of was a very iconic Clint Eastwood. And even if you go to the book's covers and you look at him, I mean, he looks like Clint Eastwood on the cover of the books. Well, Clint Eastwood was a little old, and so they kind of went a little out of the box, and they got Idris Elba to play the Gunslinger. And actually, I think Idris Elba does a great job. I think he's very different than your traditional iconic spaghetti Western character that Clint Eastwood represents. But I thought he did a fine job as the Gunslinger. I like Idris Elba, especially in these stoic action roles. And Matthew McConaughey as the Man in Black, who is, of course, Ryan O'Flagg, and he's been in other books and other movies. He was in The Stand. He's the bad guy in The Stand. So he shows up in a lot of Stephen King's books. And, Matthew McConaughey is fantastic in that role. Way better than, who is the guy, Jamie Sheridan or something, who played him in The Stand back in the 90s when they made it. He was terrible. But Matthew McConaughey is great as the Man in Black. So they got some great casting in it. And the kid who plays Jake, he's fine too. It's a relatively simple story, and it deals with just the very surface level of the story. But for what it is, for just this 97-minute movie, it's interesting enough. It bogs down a bit in sort of like the post-apocalyptic world, because this world of Midland has moved on. And so you end up with another Divergent, Hunger Games, Maze Runner, people sort of living in a weird little agrarian society that should have been fleshed out a little bit more. But ultimately, I have to say I enjoyed it for what it was. It just bogs down a bit in the middle, and it's not for the fans. I will tell you that right now. But I'm still going to have to say that The Dark Tower kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review the independent film Caps Crossing, do the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Indiana Jones. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's complete the movie review cycle with the independent film Caps Crossing. A group of geocachers venture into the woods only to be stalked by a deranged killer.
I'm surprised somebody reserved this campground. Nobody really camps here anymore.
Why is that? A couple of hikers were found dead out here. The place got a bad reputation.
Somebody was watching me as I was getting undressed.
Your boyfriend's been gone a long time.
He gets that way when he's into something.
This is my forest.
Now, this is a very independent movie. Now, it was released officially, I think it got a theatrical run in New York, LA, back in June 8th or June 10th. And you can get this on demand. It's on Amazon and Google Play. You know, it's shot in like 8 days, very limited budget. The story, it's funny because it's very similar to Lycan, and I find myself dealing with both movies, and they have very similar tropes to them. This one doesn't have a werewolf in it. It's a slasher movie. So it's not as generous with the skin as Lycan is. It's somewhat basic, and it earns my respect for the fact that it was done in such a limited time. It doesn't feel like it was a rushed production. It doesn't look like they have like scenes that were had to be abandoned. One of the problems at the opening, though, it has like, you know, a lot of times in a horror movie, you'll have like the one person coming in and they stumble onto the killer and they get killed. They have like two of those. So they should have picked one or the other, because by the time you get to the second one, it's not a big surprise. And it reminds you a little bit of, I said this about the movie Insidious 2. Where I don't think it quite worked, but what James Wan did is he said, I want to do a horror story and tell a scary bit of the movie in total brightness. And that was a challenge, and it was an interesting challenge, because mostly horror movies are dark and creepy and shadowy. It didn't work in Insidious 2, but I respect the heck out of him trying. And in this movie, the director, I think their idea was, hey, let's do a movie about a slasher, but we're not going to bother putting him in a mask. And I respect that decision. I don't think it quite worked. There's something that you do kind of need a mask. Leatherface is much scarier with his mask on. You know, Jason, even though he has a monster mask underneath it, he's much scarier. The iconic hockey mask or the Michael Myers look. And that's one of the things with the original Halloween. When he finally takes off the mask, he just looks kind of normal. And that's equally terrifying, but if you just had a normal guy running around killing everybody, you lose the imagery. And so I think that it does suffer a bit from that, and the dialogue's not great, because you're trying to extend these characters that are really just, you know, knife fodder for the killer, and I never really got behind any of the characters. They serve these archetypes, but they kind of forgot to put in the final girl archetype. You know, you may hate some of the other characters, but they get killed off. But you always want that final girl. You want to like the final girl. And I think they're missing that in that movie. So still, Caps Crossing, you know, if you want fiercely independent, you want that grassroots 8-day shoot movie, you can check that out on Amazon and Google Play. My official review, however, I am going to have to say it does kind of suck, even though it does earn my respect for some of the things it was trying. And I think that there's greater things to come from the people who worked on this.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office really quick. I said last week that it was going to be a $25 million horse race for the Emoji Movie, Dunkirk, and Atomic Blonde. Pretty close on that. Dunkirk ended up winning with over $26 million. The Emoji Movie came in with just about $2 million less, just under $25 million. And then Girls Trip was $20 million, and then Atomic Blonde squeaked in under that. It's still a good number for Atomic Blonde, especially considering it was up against a lot in the marketplace. Dunkirk winning the weekend was, if you actually look at these numbers, I bet you the Emoji Movie, what I said last week, is it sold more tickets, but it had a lot more kids tickets, and Dunkirk has premium pricing. So I wouldn't be surprised if even though Dunkirk made more money, it sold significantly fewer tickets and was significantly less popular this week around. But everyone wanted to report that the Emoji Movie didn't make number one. This week, I think it's going to be another horse race. I think it's going to be a $20 million horse race between The Dark Tower and Kidnapped. But I think The Dark Tower, it's not getting great buzz. It's getting creamed in the reviews. And I think that's because a lot of critics have read the books. Kidnapped, I'm seeing everywhere from like $8 to $13 million as predicted on that one. I wouldn't be surprised if that one does a little better. I wouldn't be surprised if that's one's nipping at the heels of $20 million just because it's a disposable movie and I think people like Halle Berry. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week, I'm going to reach way back into the vaults and talk about the Indiana Jones series, which I recently watched this past weekend with my son, who's 9. He had never seen them, and I made him watch all 4 movies, and he loved them. He had a lot of fun, but it gave me a chance to look at them with a new perspective. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about Indiana Jones.
Jones!
Always knew someday you'd come walking back through my door.
I'm going after that truck.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm making this up as I go.
You know how to fly, don't you?
No. Do you?
Of course, everybody agrees Raiders is a great movie. And the one thing I like the most about Raiders is the pacing. The action's great, and the setup's great, and the story's great, but the pacing is really impressive because that movie gets a lot of information and exposition out in these bursts that of these scenes that take 2 minutes, then they go right to an action sequence. A great example is when they go to Cairo and they meet at Saleh's house and he's talking about the map room and Belloc is there with all the people he's hiring in Egypt to do the dig. And then they go out into the marketplace and boom, you're in an action sequence. They don't waste any time. Spielberg is probably one of his most tightly plotted movies, and it's still a fantastic movie. It holds up, and I think I would argue that it's the best one. I don't think anybody's disagreeing on that one. Now, the third one, let's skip to the third one really quick. The third one's a lot of fun, but the third one still is silly and goofy and absurd, and a lot of people complained about the second one being a little bit too silly. This one also has some silliness as well, but it's fun. I think by the third movie, they're just enjoying the ride. And by putting in Sean Connery, and you got to remember back then, I mean, he'd only played James Bond in Never Say Never Again like 6 years before that. So he had settled into the I'm an older guy now role. But still, there's some silly moments. The tapestry discussion is goofy. The no ticket thing. There's a lot more deliberate humor in the sequels than you have in the original movie. But still, the third one's a lot of fun. But see, people look at the second one, and the second one, I was like 12 when it came out. So I really liked it because I loved Short Round and I identified with him. And it was a circus ride. It was an amusement park ride. And of course, everyone hates on 4. Here's the thing though. I think people are unfairly critical of 4. And the reason for that is they're looking at the fourth movie as somebody 20 years after the last movie was made. And you can't do that. I will say the pacing is a bit different in part 4, but like 2 and 3 are very similar in pacing. Four takes its time, but I think that's more just 20 years of Steven Spielberg directing movies, and he was an older man doing it. But if you look at part four, for all the things that people just rip on that movie, there is the exact same problems in part two. You don't like Shia LaBeouf? Well, look, you had Short Round. You had a kid showing up in each one. Oh, you think nuking the fridge? They parachute out of an airplane in a life raft in the second movie. It's absurd. There's no way to make that any less absurd than getting nuked in a fridge. You don't like the sequence where they're driving through the jungle? And, you know, they're doing the Tarzan thing. Well, guess what? You had the minecart sequence in the second movie. You can also complain, well, they're aliens. Well, that works for the era. You couldn't make Indiana Jones in the 40s because Harrison Ford is noticeably older. And just as an actor, he was a different guy. So it had to take place at least 10 or 15 years after the last movie, which is the 50s. That's the 50s. That's during the Red Scare. That's during Aliens, where you didn't really have that in the 40s. You can't have the Nazis in part four. You gotta have the Soviets. That's how the politics was at the time. So that's my defense of part four. I liked all four of them. I will say there's some I like better than others. There's sequences I like better than others. And you also have to look at what they were originally supposed to be. They were serials. They were stuff that was shown on Saturday morning in the movie houses in front of other movies. These were not meant to be tightly plotted things. Raiders was great, but you're never going to get another Raiders. You know, quit dissing on the sequels. And because you want to go head-to-head with me on Crystal Skull, I'll go head-to-head with you. You can make a complaint. I will counter with any other scene in at least one of the other three movies, if not multiple movies. So I'm going to have to say that the Indiana Jones saga as a whole totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that is it. Thanks for stopping by. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Annabelle Creation and the Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.